Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. And we're happy to have back here on the program once again, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has been with us for a long, long time doing programs on a regular basis so that we can give listeners the opportunity to ask questions about women's health, her special area of practice. We've talked about a lot of different things over the years. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that maybe are new or that she just thinks it would be good for you to know about. So we can do that. But also the idea here is that it's an opportunity for people who are listening to ask questions. And the only sort of caveat we put on to the program is that because the doctor cannot see you, there's a limit to what we can do. We can't diagnose over the telephone, that there may be that it would be a question that would be more complicated and she would need to have more medical history than we could do. So there's a kind of limit to what we can do. But we also do these shows to give you the chance to get some information and ask questions. And that is certainly welcome. And I know that she'll do her best to answer any and all questions. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455 at any point. You want to pick up the telephone and give us a call? You can do that. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what do you want to talk about?
Well, I thought I would start by talking about whether or not a woman should have her ovaries taken out at the time that she has a hysterectomy. Hysterectomies are still one of the more common gynecologic surgeries. We still have something like 650,000 to 750,000 hysterectomies being performed in the United States each year for various kinds of conditions. The vast majority are actually done for uterine bleeding, which, as we've talked about before, has other causes, other treatments, and so it's not true that everyone who has that would need a hysterectomy. But one of the most important decisions a woman can make when she's having this hysterectomy is whether or not her ovaries need to come out. And I know patients sometimes get the word hysterectomy a little bit confused as to whether it does mean removing the uterus and the ovaries or just the ovaries. Doctors say subtotal hysterectomy if we're going to just take out the top of the uterus and leave the actual cervix. But patients often use the word partial hysterectomy, which is not a medical term. Patients will tell me, I've had a partial hysterectomy, meaning the top of their uterus was removed, their cervix was removed, but their tubes and ovaries were conserved. And doctors don't use that term at all. They say hysterectomy or ovarectomy, ovarian removal, being ovarectomy, meaning ovarian removal. So trying to help patients understand whether or not they should remove their ovaries at the time of hysterectomy is probably a lot of the focus of hysterectomy counseling.
Mm-hmm.
We think that ovaries will remain functional for the production of estrogen until the natural age of menopause, whether or not you remove the uterus, but ovaries will still actually produce a lot of hormone after menopause, including the production of testosterone, a male hormone. So when we used to give the age of sort of 50 as a good ballpark, after 50, we're going to take out all these ovaries because they're not going to produce estrogen anymore. A reanalysis has been done a couple of different times looking at different aspects of the question. But a reanalysis has been done looking at the removal of normal ovaries at the time of hysterectomy. And probably that age 50 could be easily crept up to the age of 65, and maybe it should even be set higher altogether.
So just leave, unless there's some compelling reason to remove them, now it's your
ladies
where I say leave them alone, leave them there.
And this new study looked at 24 years of follow-up of women who'd had their ovaries removed at the time of hysterectomy, and they found that the overall risk of death from any cause increased by 12%. Now, this is over 24 years, and some of these patients were, of course, not young. The risk of heart disease actually increased by 17%, and their statistic on that means that out of every 130 women who had her ovaries removed, there was one extra death attributable to heart disease out of this group. And Also, interestingly, the lung cancer risk increased by 26%. But the researchers had no explanation for that. It was just a finding in their study. And that was a very new finding. We always know that when we look at the question of hormones, hormones affect so many parts of our bodies that we find these odd things, like use of estrogen can the use of birth control pills, which have both estrogen and progesterone, can actually reduce your risk of rheumatoid arthritis. That's a joint arthritic condition. So, you know, things that you think are not at all related to hormones often are. Now, it is true that there were benefits. So you're weighing benefits. The risk of ovarian and breast cancer did go down by about 25%. We usually quote a rate of breast cancer in our population of about 1 in 7 and a risk of ovarian cancer of about 1 in 70. So definitely ovarian removal at the time of hysterectomy has benefits in terms of protection against ovarian cancers and breast cancers. It doesn't protect against every ovarian cancer. We don't know why. In some cases, women are getting related cancers like peritoneal cancers. Peritoneum is the actual lining of the abdomen, and they aren't getting ovarian cancer after ovarian removal. In some cases, people either think their ovary was completely removed or there was an attempt at complete ovarian removal, and in fact, the complete ovary wasn't removed. So we say that about 2% of all the ovarian cancers that we find are in women who've had ovarian removal. And yet, still, one of the most common causes of death is some sort of cardiovascular disease in women. So anything that you can do to protect your heart is very important.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose some people would say, well, you can always supplement the hormones artificially after the ovaries are removed. But I suppose that still takes you back to the question, well, if you're thinking you're going to need to do that afterwards, then why remove the ovaries in the first place?
That's true. And also taking a pill every day isn't quite like having your own ovaries producing a particular hormone. And usually when we supplement, we're usually supplementing with estrogen alone and not an estrogen and testosterone, which is male hormone combination.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there a time when doctors were doing hysterectomies?
Me too. when doctors were doing
hysterectomies and then just said, well, we might as well go ahead and take out the ovaries. If you're not going to have a uterus, what's the point of having ovaries?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We take out the ovaries. We take out the appendix, throw in a tummy tuck. Still do that a little bit. But at any rate, yes. And again, you know, researchers saying weigh your risk and benefits. And people are saying to me, patients say to me sometimes in hysterectomy planning, well, I've got this time off of work. What are my odds of needing surgery on one or both of my ovaries at some point in the future? I have insurance now. What are my odds of needing surgery on my ovaries when my insurance may or may not be as active? Or, yes, I'm menopausal anyway, and my ovaries were not producing very much hormone. I'm taking hormones anyway. Perhaps that's not going to be a factor. Of course, a lot of this data dates many, many years ago, 24 years ago. Well, 24 years ago, there weren't very, very many cases of, for instance, surrogate parenting or some of the in vitro techniques that we have now to even become a mother if you're having a hysterectomy at a young age. So there were people that felt, well, I'm probably never going to have children, therefore let me get these ovaries out. Whereas now, very often we say, well, you keep your ovaries, finances and philosophies aside, it is theoretically possible to still donate an egg to a pregnancy if you have an ovary. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign every other month on a Monday. She is here, and we talk about women's health. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455.
We spend a little time talking to women about the signs and symptoms of cardiovascular disease. Heart attacks, strokes in women often do not have the same symptoms as they have in men. The symptoms could be subtle. They could be shortness of breath. They could be tiredness. They could be neck pain. They could be back pain. Not so much the shooting up and down your left arm kind of pain that men do have. And it's always a question in my office, what are some of the best tests to figure out, do I have cardiovascular disease or not? And, of course, some of the obvious tests have always been, what's your cholesterol, what's your weight, and, of course, what's your blood pressure? But now we're getting into a little bit more sophisticated testing. There's ways of testing for peripheral disease, for instance, taking a blood pressure in your ankle as well as in your arm and doing a ratio can test for peripheral disease. We can also do tests a little bit more sophisticated than just getting your BMI or your height per weight. Like we can do your waist measurement and hip measurement. And a man should have about an equal waist to hip ratio. David looks pretty good.
Oh, thank you very much.
I think he's doing well. Women, we should be about a 0.8. So our waist is supposed to be smaller than our hips. And our waist is also supposed to be smaller than a 35. And so just measuring that is pretty good. I'm working hard to get my measurements and gear. I think I'm pretty good right at the moment. But those are some simple, inexpensive tests of cardiovascular disease that you can do, that waist-to-hip measurement, if your doctor hasn't done that.
All right. I have a couple callers here. They're on cell phones. So let us get to them, starting first with someone on the toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Mary Claibon. I'm actually a health coach, but I'm calling for my own self. I am 57 years old and postmenopausal. My mother had ovarian cancer. That is not what she died of. She had a panhysterectomy. She was my age, exactly my age, 57 years old. She had a panhysterectomy. It was stage 3B or something like that, and she was on 3 chemotherapy drugs and had, the check-in surgery a year later and everything was gone. She lived another 20 years, and then in 2005, she died of pancreatic cancer. So I am postmenopausal now and still, I don't really get hot flashes. I've been seen by a Chinese doctor who's an MD acupuncturist who is also a hematology oncologist, and I go to him just prophylactically. He basically was treating me for some adrenal insufficiency but suggested that I do estrogen, testosterone, vaginal ointment or something for vaginal atrophy and did not recommend natural hormones. I'm kind of wondering, and I do get CA-125s and a pelvic ultrasound every year, so I'm wondering what the doctor, if she had any other recommendations or what her feelings are about natural hormones. And I also at one point did consider the oophorectomy, but I've pretty much been cautioned against it because my mother and I had completely different lifestyles and we're different people. So I'll stop there.
Okay, well, let's start with the fact that a lot's going on in your case, and absolutely you bring up phenomenally important issues, and that we probably won't cover all of them. But let's start with the back end first. Your question in terms of the hormone therapy and ovarian removal to prevent ovarian cancer is probably critical in carriers of the BRCA 1 and 2 gene. Gene typing is quite controversial.
Yeah.
The BRCA 1 and 2 gene got a lot of press in the media just this past week or two because Myriad Genetics, which is, I think very highly of that company. So I'm not weighing in on this lawsuit at all. Just got a little bit of press. Has actually patented aspects of that gene and that test, which is, I think, the controversial part of that. But in women who have parents who have, or what we call a first degree relative, mom, sister, daughter, grandmother, all, well, mom, sister, daughter are definitely the first degree. Grandmother, a little bit more remote, but lots of grandmas, lots of aunts. That's probably enough, but definitely first degree relative with ovarian cancer, depending on one's philosophy, might be the ideal candidate for gene testing. And for those carriers of BRCA 1 and 2, you probably reduce your risk of breast and ovarian cancer dramatically if you get appropriate treatment, dramatically in the ranges of 60 to 80%, depending on who you are and what your risks are and so forth and so on. So probably answering the question without knowing more specifics. Second part of your question, so I think my answer to that part would be consider that testing. Look into it. You can go to the Myriad website. You can go to a physician that offers that testing. There are a lot of direct-to-consumer gene testing companies. The one that I think has been getting the most press is 23andMe. I think it's 23X, the number 23X, and me, I think, and then .com.
And the only question I have about that, is that confidential and within my confidential record so that I do not have
and
to disclose
that's
that
what,
to my
that's what you
company.
Need to – That well, you need to just read all the information, and I do spend a lot of time talking to patients about what's disclosable and what's not, and remember that if you choose not to answer questions on a particular form, that may or may not invalidate, you know, what happens, whether or not you have that information. Okay, let's go back now. So one thing would be to, just to wrap up that part, just in case I made it too confusing, was to consider gene testing before you would consider any sort of oophorectomy. And the next part, natural hormones. The word natural, of course, is a very confusing subject. So our ovary makes estradiol, a compound that would be, quote unquote, bioidentical and very natural to estradiol, could be made synthetically. Estrogens that come from nature, where you take them and you're using them exactly from nature, could be considered natural. So, for instance, Premarin, they take it from horse urine, natural, not natural for a woman, but natural. So it's a different use of the word. There's also compounded bioidenticals, and those are mixed rather than written necessarily as a prescription typical drug. So the word natural has a lot of different meanings. As to make a very long story, as short as I can possibly make it, basically an estrogen is an estrogen, it's an estrogen. That's not quite true, but the class has class effects, and the risks that you're going to incur are the risks, regardless of whether it's natural from a horse, natural from a laboratory, natural from a compounded pharmacy. And the benefits are there as well. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly how an individual reacts and how the formulation can be tailored to your own specific needs, that varies. And then lastly, the issue of vaginal atrophy. There are a small percentage of women that will never get vulvovaginal atrophy and can stay sexually active late into life, 90s, without treatment. But I can't say I have any patients over 100, but come on in and see me, somebody. I don't know. But I have lots of patients in their 90s. But
is the estrogen, testosterone. I use Replenz, and that seems to work. I'm not sure I need need any other thing, but that was the Chinese doctor, who is an MD oncology hematologist. He said no natural hormones. He said exactly what you did, because I have a specialist gynecologist for chronic ureaplasma, which is another issue that you could talk about, actually. And when I asked him, he gave me a note that said no, and my gynecologist said no. So
you've got your team agreeing, and that's a very important aspect of healthcare, to have our team agreeing. And that will be a big benefit of some sort of nationalized health record. But thank you for your comments. Very perceptive.
If I get off the phone, I'm just going to throw out two more things. DHEA, I take those supplements. That was for the adrenal insufficiency and also postmenopausal thyroid insufficiency or whatever. I don't, you know, those are things. As we age,
both other hormone glands can age with us. And we like to call the aging of the adrenal gland adrenopause, and men can get that too, so David can listen up. But but it is something that can be tested for in laboratory testing and then treated.
Yeah, that's exactly what I had. Well, that's it. Well, thank you so
all
much.
Right,
I'm going to just listen to the show.
Hopefully
my question was helpful.
Already our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's one here on this program every other month. On a Monday, we talk about women's health, and it's an opportunity to ask questions, maybe get some basic information on the areas where she works. And give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we're looking for a caller here, line one, someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm pleased to be talking to the fine doctor. 12 years ago, you gave me a second opinion and said, go do that. And I had breast cancer and had treatments over at the Carl Clinic, and it was successful. But my question is about ovaries and chemotherapy. I was treated with four massive doses of Adriamycin and cytoxin, and of course I was not in menopause at the time. I was just turning 50. And they told me, well, you'll be done with it by the time this treatment is finished. So what happened to my ovaries, and are they totally dead? Or now it's 10, 12 years later, are they contributing anything to my health?
We do know that cancer treatments can affect our endocrine glands, and the ovaries are particularly sensitive in some people, although even pregnancies after chemotherapy for breast cancers have been reported. So in a younger woman, we have good signals of whether their periods come back or their periods don't come back. If they resume regular cycling, even after chemotherapy treatments, we know there's probably been some egg loss, but there's still a lot of residual ovarian function. We all start fetal life with about 4 million eggs. At the end of fetal life, we only have about 1 million eggs, and we only ovulate 400 in our lifetime. So we have tremendous ovarian reserves in the way of our follicles, which eventually each follicle produces a fertile egg, but it's the follicles and the tissue of the ovary that also are responsible for producing our hormone. So understanding what the specific effects of a round of chemotherapy are on a particular ovary does have something to do with your phase of life. It also has something to do with the dose and the timing of the treatments, and knowing what your ovary is producing right now would be a fairly easy question to answer with a little bit of hormone testing. But if you were 50 when you had chemotherapy and 10 years later, most likely you have no estrogen production, no progesterone production, and there's probably been significant waning of testosterone production from your ovaries, if we were to guess. I mean, if we just, you know, set that up as a theoretical case. But definitely it's something that could be tested for. The flip side is, why ask a question if you're not going to use the results of the answer? So,
right.
For instance, would you be a safe candidate, say, to replace this loss estrogen or testosterone? And I think the general consensus is that low levels of hormone use, say, topically in the case of the vaginal atrophy, like we happened to be talking with the last caller on. I don't know if you were listening, but those kinds of treatments are generally safe for cancer patients because we use them in such low dose that we don't have much systemic uptake. But to really be on systemic therapy for hormone replacement in a scenario of post-breast cancer, somebody would really have to be really bothered by their hormonal symptoms and probably be an exception rather than the rule. So you might, you know, we could do the tests, but I don't know what we would do with the answers necessarily.
Right, right. No, and I'm not particularly bothered. I was just, when I was listening to you earlier in the show, I was thinking, well, you know, did the chemotherapy totally destroy the ovaries or, you know, as you say, though, some of the function sometimes comes back.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's all I need to know.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
Thank
well,
you.
Other questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. It's our regular program on women's health. So if you have questions, you can give us a call.
And I was going to say also in response to the question mm-hmm. about chemotherapy and ovaries, it's also important to know what the impact on one's bones has been. So even if you have a transient or a short-term impact on your hormone therapy or on your hormone levels in your body, they may have had an impact on your bones, and we can only find that out by actually testing your bones and doing a bone density test.
Mm-hmm. We got some other folks coming in. We'll take some other calls. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, and this would be on our line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a hysterectomy when I was about 40, which included the cystocele repair. And now in my mid-70s, I'm having trouble with rectocele. What do you recommend?
Well, there are really only a couple of alternatives to treatment of rectocele, and one would be to get a pessary device. But most people are not that happy with them, but pessaries are made of either rubber or latex or silicone. If you have a problem with that, they come in various sizes and shapes, and basically they're devices that you get fitted for, and it just holds everything up in place. And for some women, that's satisfactory. Most people wear them during the day, take them out, wash them, air dry them, use them the next day. They can be left in for several days, even a week or so, which is actually very safe by the way they're designed. Also, surgical repair does help rectoceles, and usually it's something that you can have a consultation with a gynecologic surgeon, and one of us could help you decide what type of surgery. Some of these repairs work really well with the old-fashioned, what we call posterior repair, without any uses of mesh. And in some cases, it's not just the rectocele coming down. It's what we call an enterocele. So that's a bulging of the top part of the vagina where actually there is colon coming down and the actual support of the vagina has been lost due in part to aging. In part, it may be due to disruption of that sling that supports the pelvis that was probably cut through in the normal process of performing the hysterectomy. And so you really need a pelvic exam to figure out the diagnosis. We also sometimes get what we call lateral defects, so the sidewalls of the vagina sometimes do weaken and need a proper repair. And so the type of repair and the location is something that a physician can help you understand. That area of anatomy is tough to understand, but the BARD website, BARD is a urological company, B-A-R-D, and I know they have a patient website. I don't know if it's bard.com. I don't think it is. I think it's something else like bardurologic.com or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they have great pictures of the anatomy. And I know we have some ways of showing you the different. It's a dynamic program that shows you how things prolapse. It's really very cool.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Very good. On to Newark, Illinois, line number 2.
Hello. Hello.
Yes.
Okay. This is Bob. My wife died of pancreatic cancer March 9th. And my daughters have the same body type as she. I was just wondering, what is the statistics on men and women dying of pancreatic cancer? She died in 17 days after her diagnosis. Tremendous pain.
Very sad. Pancreatic cancer, very sad case. Well, it's relatively rare. There are some syndromes that link pancreatic cancer with other cancers, but very often it's an isolated kind of finding. There are genetic counselors that help people work through all of this, or some family physicians and internists have a little bit of experience in genetic counseling to sit down and work through your family tree. That's what some of these genetic websites do. They help you work through your family tree to figure out if, in fact, there are any hereditary syndromes or not, and to figure out not only what you're predisposed for, but how you should then go about your health care. For instance, the American Cancer, I know this isn't about pancreatic cancer, but off the top of my head, I don't know a specific recommendation about pancreatic. But for instance, for those carriers of the BRCA genes, American Cancer Society has come up with different recommendations. You're supposed to start your mammograms earlier and consider getting MRI tests instead of all that radiation exposure after a certain point. So there are different recommendations in individuals that have hereditary predispositions, and that's what genetic counselors do.
Okay, her dad died in 53 of liver cancer, probably the same thing. So there is a predisposition probably in the family, so I should...
May or may not be. Liver cancers are often related to hepatitis. Hepatitis C, big cause of liver cancers. So people who were exposed to individuals that had liver cancer might be candidates for hepatitis C screening, which is a simple blood test and very treatable now, wasn't a number of years ago. So those kinds of things need to be worked through with your family physician as well.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Certainly other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. That just, I suppose, in my mind, just raises the question about genetic testing, that as we go along and we have the potential to tell people that as a result of genetic screening, to tell them that they perhaps have greater risk of certain kind of conditions. How do you balance that with the fact that it may be in some of those cases we would be telling someone that you're at risk for developing a certain disease, but we have no intervention, we have no treatment, we can't do anything about it?
Well, you're pointing out a very good negative point to genetic testing, but there's a lot of positive as well. Mm-hmm. For instance, genetic testing, it's not just what diseases you're predisposed to, but it's how you're going to react to certain medicines and perhaps you know, how you should eat and other things like that. So there are a tremendous amount of benefits. And just because we don't have a treatment for a particular condition doesn't mean we won't ever have that treatment as well.
Do you think in the future that more genetic screening will become a more routine
thing? Oh, absolutely.
It'll just be a part of your you go and you have your checkups and stuff.
I do. There'll be people that object, and I think that a rational way to approach this is to talk about these ethical issues because they are very, very important. But it's becoming more and more important. And they estimate in the average gynecologist's office Probably a couple of patients a day should be getting breast cancer, BRCA1 and 2 blood test screening. And, you know, most of the gynecologists out there are not coming anywhere close to that amount of testing.
Okay. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Dr. Troopin, and it's about routine testing, mammograms and pap smears, and I can't think of any others, but there might be some. And I'm hoping that at a certain age you don't need to have those anymore if you've never had any sign of trouble.
Well, definitely we are redoing the pap smear guidelines very rapidly. American Cancer Society has some information about that on their website. American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG.org, just put out a new position paper about decreasing the frequencies of pap smears. And basically, to make a long story short, when you get into your menopausal age, I'm not making any assumptions, but
I'm 78.
Okay. Thank you. But when you get into that age, if you've had three negatives 3 years in a row and you also have a normal pap smear and a negative HPV test, probably going to fewer pap smears is very reasonable. Probably there will be selected individuals that need them, quote unquote, on indication only.
Okay. Now, what's HPV?
HPV is the human papillomavirus. HPV 16 and 18 are responsible for 80% of all cervical cancer.
Well, I should say I've also had the hysterectomy, so I don't have a cervix anymore.
Most likely you don't need a pap smear, but you may still need at least external inspection, and occasionally you may need internal inspection. And the ACOG position summarized it quite well.
Okay. Now, what about mammogram?
Well, the mammogram, that's a different story. Basically, when you get old enough to not need the information. So if you're spry and healthy enough to be treated, keep getting them every year.
Okay. All right. Thank you on behalf of other people, too, because we don't want to have any tests we don't have to have.
Absolutely.
Right, also to save Medicare. Okay.
All right. Bye. Very good. And we'll go on here. Next up, we have someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question regarding puberty and menopause relationship. Does the age of puberty onset have to do anything with the age of menopause onset?
Not really. It's a good question. The age of puberty has been lowering. So probably in the 1800s, most people went through puberty something like 14, 15. And now we're down to the average age, 10, 11. And it has something to do with our nutrition. It has something to do with our weight. But because we hit menopause when we run out of eggs, but we have so many spare eggs. And so an extra year or two of ovulation doesn't seem to affect that much. But
okay,
good question. Yeah. It runs in families more than the age of puberty.
Okay.
Which probably also runs in families. So I don't know if they've done that study factoring out the genetics. I'll have to look that up.
I was just curious about it because in my family, we tend to run a little late in the puberty area, like 14, 15, 16. And most of the menopauses have been in the late 50s, 60s. So I was wondering if there's any correlation between them.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. We'll go on here. And our next caller, I think, is in Champaign and line three. Hello.
I am, in fact, in Champaign
on
line three.
Go ahead, then.
My ears perked up when you started talking about genetic testing. Is that a discipline in and to itself, or
yes,
could you expand on that a little bit?
It is. There are physicians that specialize in genetic testing. There are individuals that are considered counselors that specialize in that. And
the difference between a counselor and the
one's an MD, one's not.
How would I find an MD then?
You can look. you can look them up. I think they have an organization. I know there was a physician at Carl that was so trained, but I don't think she's practicing there. I know in our community we have several good genetic counselors, both at the university and at Carl, that are the ones that I know the most about that I refer to. But beyond that, I wouldn't know.
Would they be as capable of advising you as a full-blown MD? Or
you know, really many of the MDs are focused in a particular area, but I would think that an MD specialist would have a little bit more expertise, be a little bit more involved. The MDs can actually order blood tests. Counselors don't actually order blood tests. So I think that would be one difference.
So I'd look for, you know, physician such and such, genetic testing.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I have cancer ran in my mother's side of the family and not my father's side, and I've always been a little bit not really worried about it because I figured it's you know,
right,
it's the sort of thing I really can't dodge, you know, especially pancreatic cancer. That's what killed my father.
What you might want to do is try to at least to begin with sketch out what we call a three-generation pedigree. So you, the generation before you, and the generation before that. Go to as many family members as you can and write down just what their diagnosis is.
I'm in trouble and, there.
I know. Many of us do not know. Many of us don't know, or many, many people left us without giving us a lot of medical information.
Yeah.
And so this is what the future is coming. And that's why some people just go to testing their own genes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of information out there. Some of it almost too massive for any of us to process.
The genetic testing MD would be able to actually do a DNA test or have the facility?
Yes, they can do that. They might discourage you from doing that, but they certainly can do that. And some DNA tests are very specific for certain types of things, and some are more general. It's more the direct-to-consumer advertising ones that do your whole DNA.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit controversial.
I might have to do that just because I have but one living aunt of my parents' generation, and I just, and you know, I can only guess about my grandparents. You know, it's
sure.
Both of my grandmothers were dead before I was born, and of different things. One was an auto accident, and other things. But okay, I'll look. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And it sounds like there are a couple different things here. There's actually having the test done and deciding what it is you're going to look for,
absolutely.
And then somebody to talk to about. No, okay, what is it? What does it mean?
Absolutely. And so you need pre-counseling and you need post-counseling. And then you need ongoing counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, even in the BRCA 1 and 2 testing, they have made advances in that test. So somebody that got tested, say, 5-8 years ago, there are better tests out there now than there were then. So it's very complicated, and that's why many physicians have sort of done the opt-out. They refer to the counselors because they feel they maybe don't have enough time in their general day to do the pre- and the post-counseling.
Well, is it possible to have – I mean, just I'm talking about on the theoretical level, that is what – not theoretical, what it is actually possible to do to take someone's genes and screen – for everything that you could screen for? And if you were doing that, how many tests would you actually be doing?
You're a good candidate to get on those websites and read about it. There are dozens of tests that they do. I was just talking, I'm not trying to give any ads. It just so happened that I talked to some people when I was at the American College of OBGYN Society meeting, and to get your genes screened at one of these sites. And I happen to be talking to these 23andMe people, but I think it's $400.
Wow.
But and they have genetic counselors through these websites. Mm-hmm. And a PhD researcher who does a lot of work in the area of genetic screening who was giving a talk to our overall group was saying that that is one of the better sites. But there are some other sites where she questions their technology. And these sites, their technology is not being overseen by the normal laboratory standards. So even knowing if you got an accurate test, that's an issue.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have time for at least one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Well, just a quick point about the testing, though. I tried to go through that, and insurance doesn't always pay for it.
No, it won't necessarily.
Right. They did say only if a first-degree, you mentioned first-degree relatives.
So
yes. It can be, I was surprised you said 400 for a whole screening.
Well, no, I know. Well, the BRCA test now, let me correct that. I know where you're going here, I think. But the BRCA test is about a $3,500 test. But I have been very pleasantly surprised for the patients that want it. It often is covered. And the what the Myriad Genetics people have designed is that you can you fill out your information, you have your blood drawn, they send the blood drawn to Myriad, then they will check with your insurance company, call you back and say, this is going to be your out-of-pocket cost. And they say the average out-of-pocket cost is $50 to $150 for most people on that whole $3,500 test.
Right.
So, and then when they tell you what your out-of-pocket cost can be, you can say, yes, run my test, or please, no, don't run my test.
Right.
So they are really, they have set it up to make it very easy, because an individual doctor office is very difficult for us to do that checking for all
right.
of our patients.
Yeah, and that was the where the first degree relative came in. At least with my own insurance company, they would not cover the expense because
right.
it wasn't a first degree relative who had had the gene mm-hmm. testing before and found them. So that was disappointing. But the one thing I was wondering about here is diabetes runs in my family. I've had gestational diabetes during my pregnancies. And it's been a while, but I haven't checked my blood on a regular basis. When would I anticipate having a problem?
We recommend that everyone who's had gestational diabetes have screening annually for diabetes.
Okay, and that would include like a fasting thing?
Well, yes, that's a good point. The fasting blood sugar has been our standard, more extensive glucose screenings. I'm reading more and more that they may go to hemoglobin A1C as the blood test of choice for screening. So, again, check with your own healthcare provider and see what they are going to recommend for you, but approximately annually. And each year that a woman ages who's been a gestational diabetic, she has a slightly increased chance of becoming a diabetic, but it's by no means universal.
Okay. So just keep checking with the doctor and they'll keep telling me what to do.
Yes.
Great. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. We got one more caller here in Will County, line four. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I have a quick question about resources. To keep it short, familiar with the book Issue of Blood?
Oh, I haven't read that one. I think I've heard of it, but
Let me shorten it then. What I'm looking for is a good book similar to that, which talks about genetic screening and has chapters on the preemptive remedies that result from genetic screening, the unwarranted remedies that have caused more harm than good, the intellectual property snake pit, which
is
conveys
the
people's
reason.
Conveys people, the rights of people's genes, and then the lab methods confusion about where authenticity and reliability lies. These are some of the all the issues that need to come together before anybody considers genetic testing. And I'm wondering if there are any books you know that cover this in a comprehensive way.
Well, it's a very good question, and I'm supposed to write an email to the speaker I was mentioning about, and just this conversation tweaks my brain, reminding me that it's on my to-do list, and I'll try to come up with a couple of good books, but
okay.
You are absolutely right. These are critical issues. They are being looked at. I don't know that we're going to have some easy answers. I think this technology is barreling fast and furiously at us, and it's important to learn about it.
Right. I'm afraid we're going to have some very intense and advanced answers that are partial. and no comprehensive, well-rounded answers because components of the problem are being examined at different rates in totally different camps that don't talk to each other. So that's how we're broke.
Well, I appreciate the question. Maybe you can help us find someone that we can talk to and actually do a show about this.
Yeah,
I think we need to do that.
I will. I think it's a great topic.
Well, is there any last thing that you, maybe about 30 seconds, you want to mention?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about hormones and your skin. You lose 30% of your collagen within the first 5 years of menopause. And so if anybody was going to do anything that's collagen building, and you're thinking about that, you definitely get the most bang for your buck if you treat yourself right in those first 5 years around menopause.
Okay. Well, there, I guess we'll have to stop with the promise that month after next, Suzanne will be back. She is Suzanne Troopin is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's with us every other month on the show. We talk about women's health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here.